Hi, I'm Dr. Avanti Kumar Singh. In over 20 years of practicing both Western medicine and Eastern healing traditions, the most important thing that I've learned is that healing is a journey we take together. So on this podcast, I'll be demystifying Ayurveda and other integrated medicine, showing how these simple ancient practices are the keys to unlocking a healthy modern life. We are all healing catalysts because healing starts within. It starts with you, and it starts right now. This is a Soulfire production. Episode number 125. Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my. Or rather, hot flashes, night sweats, and insomnia. Oh my. These are definitely my reality right now. And if these symptoms sound familiar to you, you're likely also navigating the challenging waters of menopause, or maybe you're supporting someone through menopause. If so, don't go anywhere because today we're diving into all things menopause and Ayurveda. Hello, hello, my beautiful friends. Welcome back to the Healing Catalyst podcast. And if you're new here, welcome. I'm Dr. Avanti, and I am so thrilled to be here with you again today. And to all of you, I'm so grateful that you're spending part of your day with me. I know how valuable your time is, and I'm really honored that listening to my podcast is something that you spend your time on. So thank you to all of you. So today we're going to explore not only how to manage the disruptive symptoms of menopause, but also how to understand and harness the transformative power of menopause, because there's so much more to this life stage than just dealing with hot flashes and night sweats and mood swings and sleepless nights. We're going to peel back the layers on this natural phase through the integrative lens of Ayurveda with my guest, Dr. Claudia Welch. Dr. Welch has been a lifelong student of medicine and life with a focus on women's health. She's a licensed doctor of Oriental medicine, an Ayurvedic practitioner, and the author of three books, one of which is my favorite: Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life, Chinese Medicine and Western Science, and The Four Qualities of Effective Physicians. She's lectured internationally on Oriental medicine and Ayurveda, exploring how Eastern medicine applies to women's health. In our conversation, Dr. Welch shares why menopause is an opportunity to embrace a transformation that can enlighten every aspect of our lives. We also discuss the physiological changes our bodies undergo as we have decreased levels of estrogen and progesterone, what Dr. Welch describes as a time of shape-shifting and rearrangement, which I love, of not just our physical bodies, but also our mental, emotional, and spiritual bodies. We also dive into the real scoop on hormone therapy, its benefits, its risks, and the eye-opening data from studies like the Women's Health Initiative. And finally, Dr. Welch guides us through practical, life-altering Ayurvedic practices and herbal remedies that both soothe and balance the symptoms of menopause, including hot flashes, sleep disturbance, vaginal dryness, and joint pain. And she also shares a really important perspective on weight gain and weight redistribution that so many of us struggle with during menopause. You know, I've been a big fan of Dr. Welch for many, many years. I've read her books and followed her work. And so this conversation with her was really a thrill for me. I know that you'll really appreciate her perspective that blends ancient wisdom with cutting-edge science to turn what many view as a time of struggle into a period of renewal and empowerment. I am so honored to share with you my conversation with Dr. Claudia Welch about navigating menopause from an Ayurvedic perspective. Well, hello, Dr. Welch. I am so excited to meet you. I have been fangirling you for many, many years, reading your books. And so it's just such an honor to have you. Thank you so much for being on my podcast.
Thank you for the invitation and for everybody who's listening for your time and attention. And thanks for the kind words.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, today we're going to jump into talking about menopause and Ayurveda. You are an expert on this topic. You've written a book about it. You've written many articles. You have courses. And so when I started getting a lot of questions from my community about menopause and Ayurveda, I thought you were absolutely the person I needed to talk to. So I would love if we could start sort of with just a little bit of background for the listeners, you know, about Ayurveda and menopause, sort of an Ayurvedic perspective. You know, we talk about in Ayurveda transitioning from one life stage to the next during adulthood to wisdomhood. And that sort of coincides with the time of menopause, not for everyone, but generally. And so it's this idea of transitioning from the Pitta time of life to the Vata time of life. So how does that relate to menopause from an Ayurvedic perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I guess I'd like to just share before answering that question that while I think this is a really valid starting point and exploration point, my favored perspective on menopause as a transitionary stage mm-hmm. is more in line with the four ashramas, the four stages of life.
Yes.
I tend to think of it more in that way and experience it that way more myself, the actual transition, which for any of the listeners who are not familiar with that, there, you know, in India, there's four stages of life. Well, and I say in India, but in some traditions, in many traditions in India, we talk about the four stages of life, the first being, without using all the Sanskrit words, the first being sort of student, and the second being householder stage, the third being this starting to move out of householder, out of responsibilities to children and home and making a living and all these things, into more of a partial retreat into ourselves and partial coming out and helping the next generation with the wisdom that we've accumulated. And then the fourth stage being a further withdrawal from the worldly arena. And so for me, that transition from the emphasis on profession, the emphasis on children, the emphasis on gaining an HDTV and an SUV and a PhD and all the initials, the emphasis from that to what's next, that transition, that sandhi, which is a wonderful Sanskrit word, that sandhi, that joint, that transition is often correlates and corresponds with menopause. And I find that to be more universal and more important when we're really talking about menopause, because the pitta to the vata transition is very useful, but the vata stage of life will be from now on, from menopause on. So that's a longer stage. The transition from pitta to vata is felt differently by different doshas. So let's address the pitta to vata stage, but then let's go back and talk a little bit, if you could, about grihastha, the householder stage, to the next stage. So the pitta to vata, again, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, but it's definitely there. It's kind of underlying. So the pitta stage of life kind of corresponds with the grihastha, the householder stage of life, where we have ambition and we're looking to our profession and we're active in the worldly arena. And what, no matter what our constitution is, there's that element of being intellectually active in our communities, in our family lives, in our professional lives, and turning attention to things that generally are associated with ambition, achieving things, right? And so that creates a certain heat and drive in the body. And often, unfortunately, in Western societies and the influence of Western societies on more indigenous and traditional societies has been such that that pitta stage of life of overdrive and ambition is overemphasized.
Yes.
And we end up feeling like there's one stage of life and it's that, and nothing is ever enough. We are never enough. Our perfectionism is never curtailed. Our money is never enough. Our prestige, our power, our influence is never enough. There's constant, how can we spread our influence and project our personalities? And this kind of influence, and with social media, that's just
magnified. Yes.
Magnified. So there's all of that. And that seems like it will never end and should never end. And we have to participate in it until we can't anymore.
Right.
So when we acknowledge that from menopause on, there's a tremendous physiological change that will leave us as a different person.
Yeah.
We will not emerge from menopause as the same person. And that old way of looking at things with the never enoughness, most of us can't tolerate that anymore. And we may push through if we're not careful and continue to try to extend that into the Vata stage of life. But it's my experience, and I suggest that we will be missing out on a lot if we don't pay attention and cooperate. So when we move into this Vata stage of life, right, Vata is more delicate. We might not have the stamina that we had to back up this unsustainable, endless expansion and drive. So our body is being more delicate, is more sensitive, more quickly responsive to what is not in alignment with our true condition at that moment, at any given moment post-menopause.
Right.
So it lands on us. There's quite a responsibility for us to pay close attention to our innermost essence, to the best that we can reach that, to hear, what can I sustain in this moment and in this moment and in this moment, so that this increasing delicacy of the constitution can maintain and sustain what I'm doing,
right,
in a healthy way, rather than slowly crumbling and falling apart or quickly crumbling and falling apart. Now, I'll stop in a second, but I do want to suggest too that the falling apart is a natural part of things. There's birth, growth, maturation, disintegration, and death. These are all part of the natural aspects of life. So it's not like, here's 10 tips to an easy menopause.
Right, right.
That's not going to happen, right? So that's one part of that natural transition from Pitta to Vata, is recognizing there's going to be differences. The body will be more delicate. There'll be more dryness. We may have to shift our diet accordingly, mm-hmm, our lifestyle accordingly, our relationships accordingly, and our expectations of ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. And so one question before we go back to the four stages of life that you spoke of first is, you know, the way I've always thought of it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, during this middle part of our lives, the Pitta stage, when we are, you know, actively in our careers, in our work, in our, you know, taking care of children, taking care of elders, like there's so many things going on. We need that fire, that drive for us to be able to be that way in the world. But as we start to go to this transition period, when we're going to start transitioning into the Vata period of life, we also have an accumulation of that Pitta, is the way I also think of it, which can sometimes explain the symptoms that we are feeling at that transition, that perimenopause, menopause transition. I think that that's always the way I've thought about it, and I'll actually try to explain it to students and patients when they're sort of like, well, I don't, you know, how does this fit? How do I understand menopause from an Ayurvedic standpoint? Because if I am trying to live an Ayurvedic lifestyle and I'm very in tune with, you know, trying to get back closer to balance on a daily basis through the things I'm eating, through the practices that I'm doing, right? Having that conscious awareness, well, then why am I having so much difficulty at this transition? And that is one of the ways I've explained it, that it is this natural accumulation of the heat of Pitta that we have to contend with and figure out, you know, and again, it shows up differently for each person depending on your doshic constitution. So I don't know if that's a correct way to think about it or...
Oh, I think that's brilliant, Avanti G. I think that's brilliant, actually. And I have never actually heard it described exactly that way, but I think that's absolutely true. And when we look at, you know, there's the microcosm and the macrocosm, right, idea in Eastern medicine in general and Ayurveda specifically. So what's going on inside of me is going on in the world. And I like to look at that in temporal time cycles as well. So what's going on in a year, if the Pitta time of year is the summer.
Correct.
And at the end of summer, when we're going into a more Vata false time, what happens then every year? We can look at that as women, like, and see what happens to me at the end of every summer. And if we've paying attention and we have a fair amount of pitta in us, especially, yes, we can see what happens. At the end of summer, we're having skin rashes and headaches and heat and irritability. And what do you need to do then? You know, I think in the change of seasons, we need to disengage the gears a little bit, go into neutral for a little while, take the pressure off. Because again, that's a sundi, it's a junction. Yeah. And these sundis are vulnerable points of vulnerability. So for example, the joints in my fingers, the joints in my knees, joints, sundis in the body, we can see that those are vulnerable places for injury. In the same way, there's these junctions of time, right? So when we go from one season, whether that's a climate season of the year or a season of our life, when we're going from one to the other, to disengage and give some space and simplify the diet at that time, and either do some kind of panchakarma cleansing measure at that time is really great, mm-hmm, or do a very simple thing. Do, for example, one day a week for a while of just khichdi for the day.
Right.
Something very simple to disengage. So I love that point of view.
Okay, great. Well, wonderful. I'm excited that was a good way to explain it. And so let's go back really quickly before we move on, because I have so many questions, but I do want to go back to your original sort of point about the way that you've often described this menopausal change in terms of the four stages of life that we talk about, you know, the student householder, that in-between householder to, you know, retreat, that in-between time and then retreat. So could we go back to that?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, since I was quite young, I've been exposed to this idea of, well, childhood, since childhood, I've been exposed to this idea of four stages of life. And so they've always resonated with me. And I've always felt that they are an intellectually great way to see our lifespan. But I'll say that for me, going through menopause, and when I say going through menopause, I really realize it's really way more than about the cessation of the menstrual cycle. It feels much bigger than that. It is a tremendous life change. I mean, arguably the deepest system of the body, the endocrine system that governs all the hormonal actions in the body, is completely rearranging. We're shape-shifting. We don't come out the other end of this the same. So in terms of the four stages of life, when we're looking at this, when I saw that in my childhood, that there's these four stages, right, I saw intellectually that made sense, but going into this third stage, it's different. It's not just menopause. It's a tremendous rearrangement of so many aspects of us, the physical aspect, the emotional aspect, the spiritual aspect, everything changes. Yeah. So it helped me look forward to that and prepare for that. And I think that there's a preparation that is very useful, but not essential, mm-hmm, that happens in the previous two stations of life, the student stage of life and the householder stage of life. Mm-hmm. If we weren't well prepared in those stages, then the transition is a little harder,
right,
but it's not a lack of hope. We can make up for that deficiency, mm-hmm, if we have a little understanding and education and awareness around it.
Right.
So that's helped me. And in one way that I've found around this is, it's not just this physical transition. There's some parts of this transition that are instantaneous and some that take 10 years, mm-hmm, to go through.
Right.
I remember sitting right here where I'm sitting right now, and it's April 2024 now. So like it was February, I think, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had been looking in this direction my whole life and something turned my head. And ever since, I've looked in that direction and never seen reality the same way since.
Yes.
That was something that happened instantaneously, but many aspects have happened over a year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years. It's not menopause. It's a whole transition of being.
Yes. And so, you know, I think that actually gets to something I was thinking about. It's actually a question, but we can talk about it this way, is that, you know, in many traditional cultures, menopause is not viewed just as a biological transition. That's a very Western point of view, you know, coming from you know, the medical world that I come from as an MD, that is the way we're sort of presented it, right? But it's really, as you're saying, more of a all-encompassing transition, right? It's spiritual, it's emotional, it's physical also. But the spiritual and emotional are also happening, even relationships. It's sort of what you were saying is that we are shifting in every way. And I think what the point you're making is that there's that biological piece that might happen, you know, over a few years, but there's this other piece that may take longer, the emotional, spiritual perspective, even sort of what you were talking about, looking from one direction to the next. That's a full perspective change.
It is. And, you know, how it's important, because why does it matter that our perspective is changing? How we see things matters. And if we look at that statement a little closer, how we see things matters is matter, you know, materializes. How we see things materializes. Thought creates biology. So how we see this transition is going to affect how the transition happens. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, so in terms of those four stages, if people aren't familiar with them, this third stage that we're going into through, let's call it menopause, but this huge transition is vanaprastha, which is the stage where we are to be living in a forest. And that's metaphorical, and sometimes it's actual.
Right.
But the idea is to retreat some and start this more inner journey and take a little bit more space. And when we look at menopause as this thing to fear, or that it's an end to something, an end to all the important things, sexiness and power, and you become invisible. Oh my God, thank God we become invisible sometimes. Like, that gives us a little bit of space. That invisibility, if that happens, can give us a little bit of space to go in, to turn the attention, which has been going out to all these things for so long, inward, to nourish that internal terrain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's an incredible time of life.
It is. It is. And I mean, I'm in that time of life too. So I absolutely understand what you're saying. I actually think that in a way, it's a very powerful time because of that perspective change and that ability to start going inward. There's sort of this reflection in a different way than I, for myself anyway, that I've ever experienced at any other time of my life. I like to think of myself as a reflective person, but this transition has really made me reflect in such a different way. And I have found it didn't happen right away, but I have found that there is more power in that, in the sense, and I don't mean, you know, trying to exert my power, but I feel more powerful in the sense of I have a clear vision of what it is that I want to do. I have released sort of the attachment to so many things that I was attached to before. And so I have more time to focus on the things that are the most important to me as I'm going into this next phase of life. So I have actually been able to rewrite it for myself as a very powerful time, regardless, you know, even though I'm having the hot flashes and all these, you know, other symptoms, which we'll get into, because that is a very real thing and it can really affect your life on a daily basis. But from an emotional, spiritual viewpoint, I have found it to be very powerful for myself.
Absolutely. But one thing I would like to shift here a little bit is there's this idea of the powerful woman, like be in your power, this kind of thing. And sometimes in my grihastha stage of life, in the householder stage of life that was so busy, I would hear that and I would think, could I, rather than stand in my power, could I like nap in my power?
Right.
A little bit. There's times where we're not powerful. We're sick, we're tired, we're spent, we're exhausted emotionally, or our nervous systems are spent. And we think, forget power. I don't have it in me to get breakfast, you know? And I remember one time somebody asked my guru, they said, they were standing in front of the Himalayas and they said, Guruji, give us the strength to climb the inner mountains. And he said, best to ask God to drag you up. And so where I think that there's more power, it's not like I'm more powerful. It's I'm taking more space to tune into that inner well of power and connect with that quietly or actively, depending on the moment. And that can really fill the space, that in a profound way, not in a cluttered way. And then the things that I'm doing can be more from that space. And I have the time, I have the commitment to let go of things that don't matter as much and to commit to those things that do matter, that I'm tuning in to my innermost essence about and aligning with that. These things matter. And there's a power in that clarity. So it's not a power in this projected personality. That's useless, I think, in my experience.
Right.
It's not personality power. It's cosmic power, universal power. Yes. That we're tuning into, that we're not projecting and trying to create.
Yes, yes. And I would agree. And I think that your point is well taken, is that I think that what I'm describing for myself is this inner power that I feel, and it allows me to be in the world in such a different way that I have found to be just really just wonderful, you know, and not distressing, even though some of the physical symptoms are, you know, very difficult on a daily basis, I will admit. So I would love for us to turn to that. And before we go into sort of some of the Ayurvedic, you know, practices, some of the strategies that we have for menopause or for this time of life, you know, I would love to hear what your perspective is on hormone treatment, because this is something that's, you know, talked so much about in Western medicine. It's a lot of people have been talking about it very much in the last few years as more of us are, you know, entering this phase of life and we really want some answers and some direction. So what do you feel or, you know, is sort of an Ayurvedic viewpoint on hormone therapy?
Yeah. Okay. It's such a good question. And first of all, I want to say, and not to be self-promoting, but there's a lot to this. And if people want to know more about this answer, then I can share here. There's the book, Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life, that talks about this in quite some detail, and Women's Health and Hormonal Balance and Stagnation, which is an online course that I have. And so those will go into this more deeply and clearly than I can go into here.
Yes.
However, in brief, first of all, in terms of the Ayurvedic perspective on hormones, the conversation about hormones per se is a relatively new conversation. Ayurveda doesn't name hormones in its ancient texts, and it doesn't address hormones in the ancient texts. The first hormone-like substance wasn't discovered until 1902. That makes it a 122-year conversation, which is nothing in the blood of things, right? But what Ayurveda does give us, as well as Chinese medicine, is a perspective through which to understand hormones. So if we look deeply at the Western conversation about hormones, which has been going on roughly 120 years, which is one full dasha cycle. But anyway, if we talk about the main hormones that are involved in women's physiology, we're going to look at estrogen and progesterone as being building, nourishing, calming, grounding substances. Those are brahmana substances or santarpana substances, which are synonymous with yin, of yin and yang. So that if we look at them from a point of view of duality, we can see that those are very nourishing and grounding, whereas stress hormones are very stimulating and motivating and activating. And that's more yang or langana, apatarpana substances in the body. So from that I feel like that's the most elegant perspective from Ayurveda in terms of how to understand them. And what's happening over the course of a woman's life is at around 35, these brahmana, these building, grounding, nourishing hormones, specifically progesterone, starts to decrease. And then at 50, progesterone and estrogen decrease a lot, which means that building, grounding, nourishing aspect that has been promoted and nourished for our whole lives, that is tremendously reduced. And that means that comparatively speaking, the langana aspect of things, the yang aspect of things, the stimulating, motivating, activating, drying, heating aspect of things takes over. And this is why the bones lighten. This is why secretions dry up sometimes. This is why the building aspect of building the endometrial lining every month, that goes away and the body becomes lighter in a way. Never mind, yes, some of us do gain more weight, and there's another story behind that. But right. In terms of this capacity to build, that goes away. So that's an overview.
Right. Okay, got it. And so then how does Ayurveda look at hormone replacement?
Right. Okay, so the hormone replacement business, this is a long conversation, right? But to put it in brief, you introduced me as an expert. And I want to say that I am no such thing on this. And I feel caution whenever anybody, including myself, is too confident about giving some kind of last word on what is appropriate when. But I will say that there's always new things coming out. And there's often some kind of bias, as you know, I'm sure, and as many, many people do know, in the creation and execution and reporting of studies. And so it's very difficult to figure out which studies are really good and which are not so good, and what the problems of the not so good ones are, and what the weaknesses of the really good ones might be, because no study is perfect.
Right.
And every human lifetime is a big experiment. Because so no two individual is the same. So any given substance is not going to act on any two individuals the same way.
Right.
So it's very difficult to say this thing will be good for everybody or nobody. And I wouldn't say that. What I will say that I go into quite a bit in the book is, you know, I, like many people, was very influenced by the 2002 study on synthetic hormone replacement. The Women's Health Initiative. It was on 160,000 women, as I believe. It was the biggest study of its kind. It went on for a long time and it changed the game. It was the biggest medical information in my professional career. You too,
yeah.
I would imagine.
Yes, me too, yeah.
Before that moment, every menopausal woman, practically, with very few exceptions, were told you should be on hormone replacement therapy. And that was based on a book by a charismatic guy who went around the country saying, this is so important. Your bones are going to crumble and your hearts are going to break and all this kind of stuff is going to go on and you're going to become disheveled and unappealing, you know, very quickly if you don't introduce synthetic hormone. And that study almost didn't happen because they believed that it would be unethical to have a control group of people who, of women who were not on hormone therapy. So it almost didn't happen, but then it did happen, but then it was aborted prematurely before the study was over because it was found that the risks outweighed the benefits significantly enough for them to stop the study, which is big. That does not happen so often. And especially when one of the makers of Premarin, which was the substance that was being used in that study, when one of the makers of that was one of the funders of the study. So since they were partially funding and they were supplying the medicine for it, you'd think that if there was a bias, it would be towards HRT, hormone replacement therapy, being good.
Right.
And yet the results still were so problematic that they had to end that study. So that made everybody go, okay, stop. Hold your horses, stop. There's no question that it helps for hot flashes and night sweats and these kinds of things, but these risks are too big. So then people were left with, women were left with, okay, with no recourse, and doctors were left with no recourse to address these hot flashes and night sweats.
Right.
So then other studies, specifically KEEPS and ELITE, these two studies that have come up in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, have proposed by much smaller studies, meaning less than 1,000 people, in each of these studies, by much smaller studies, they've proposed that there, and I don't know the full picture here, so I do not want to present myself as an expert, but the most I can kind of figure out after not admittedly a huge amount of study on this, but some, is that what it's looking like is that people are saying, okay, there's flaws to that initial, that huge study. And the main flaws are that women who take hormone replacement therapy within 5 years of menopause and take it for 5 years, their longevity is better than people who never take it. So they're saying there's this window of time where you should take it. Not only can you take it, but you should take it unless if you have, you know, there's still issues. If you're taking estrogen and you have a uterus, it could increase the chances of uterine cancer, and there's still risks. But it now gives this relief to women who are having hot flashes and night sweats, and it's a way that physicians can respond to these needs of their patients with something that works. My feeling about this is these are small studies. I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not saying this is true, but what is true is that there's huge financial incentive to sell these things. The drug companies made so much money because everybody was supposed to be on them, and that carpet was pulled out from under them. And so there's a huge incentive to make this good. And these studies are not that big that are turning this around. And when I looked into conflict of interests, one of them, I forget which one, had some conflict of interest. So My personal bias, I'll just be straightforward and transparent about my personal bias, is because of the need for women to want to feel more supple and have no hot flashes and no night sweats, and the need for physicians to give them something, and the financial incentive all makes me question this. Also, the fact that there's issues with these same drugs around contraceptive use, like birth control pills. These are also synthetic hormones, and they also have repercussions. We don't want them to, but they do. And so my preference is to address things with lifestyle and diet first, then with herbal remedies, and there are many. And oh my gosh, alternate nostril breathing, and we can talk about that. If those things don't work and there's real need for something else, my preference is bioidentical hormones. They seem to be better tolerated, and they make more sense to me for reasons that I go into in the book. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, and I think that, you know, goes right into what I wanted to talk about, because I do think that, again, you know, and you are correct on all of these perspectives. And this is something that I struggle with also, you know, and this is actually true in any issue that a patient is having, right? At what point do you go to the medications, the surgeries, all of that? And I come from a very integrative approach as well, that, you know, you want to help a patient. They're in distress, they're in discomfort, they're in pain, you want to help them. And so how can you do that? And so I think let's switch into, you know, the lifestyle and dietary recommendations that you would say would be really helpful as a good place to start before you go to hormones, to other, you know, means. What can we try from an Ayurvedic perspective as far as lifestyle? We can start with lifestyle and diet, and then we could go into some other things. What would you say about that?
Well, since these are the crux of what we can do, this is in the book and in the course in much better depth than I'm going to be able to say. But here's some top things. Eat whole foods, right? Eat whole foods. Really kind of try to minimize the processed foods, because the processed foods are going to be harder to digest. They're often going to have endocrine disruptive chemicals in them. Yeah, so let's say number one, before we even talk about diet, is subtract the poisons, medicine of subtractions. What are the poisons around us? Processed food, alcohol, cigarettes. And alcohol and cigarettes, I'm not saying this from a moral point of view, right?
Right.
There's issues with these, and I talk about them in the book. So not a big, heavy thing. I know we want to relax at the end of a day with a glass of wine. That's so understandable, and we should relax. But again, there's some risks. So there's some things that we can do instead of that. And those risks don't mean anything until you get the things that the risks are about, right? We don't think about breast cancer too much until we get it, right? And alcohol is a big part of that. So subtract processed foods, subtract alcohol, cigarettes, subtract stress as much as possible. right? Subtract the things we hate doing as much as possible, because stress plays a huge part in this, to the point where I think we could say when there's stress, you will have hormonal imbalance. You can't have hormonal balance in the face of stress,
right?
Which is crazy to say, because who can avoid stress?
Right.
And the answer has to be nobody. Everybody is going to have stress. But which stresses can we subtract? Which ones do we create from our belief systems of what success is and what we need to do and what we have to overreach to do and accomplish and achieve? What can we subtract? That's the first thing, right?
Yes.
Second thing, eat some whole foods. If they're freshly cooked, ideally, and simple, whether you call them Ayurvedic or not, they're going to be in the ballpark, right? There's wonderful Ayurvedic perspectives on how to eat food that's more digestible versus less digestible. So it's useful to learn about that. But if you're eating whole, freshly cooked foods, you're not going to be really off the rails. So that's just very simple beginning. Then there's two things that I want to mention that are very much in the ballpark of Ayurveda and yoga. One is Abhyanga, which is warm oil massage. One of the things that happens with this increase in lungana, increase in stimulating, motivating, activating, lightening kind of things, and vata stage of life, drying and lightening, is the nervous system gets a little more sensitive. So there's maybe more anxiety, more insomnia. And doing Abhyanga, this warm oil self-massage, you don't need to be a millionaire to do it. You don't have to go get a massage. You can get some of the right oil. And I've got on my website, I have an article about how to do Abhyanga and what kind of oils might be good for you. But that is amazing. And then alternate nostril breathing is one of the most powerful tools I have ever found for night sweats and hot flashes and mood swings, those kinds of things that are happening. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be fancy. Gentle. Find somebody, some yoga teacher. Almost every yoga teacher knows how to do these, right? Yeah. So you can do those. On my website, I do have a visualization of alternate nostril breathing, Nadi Shodhana. And that's hands-free. You can just do it sitting down and imagine it, and it still works. And just 5-10 minutes a day, maybe really 10 minutes would be great. But in the morning, every day helps. And the only thing I would say is it only helps if you do it. Like, there's so many yoga teachers that I'll say, you know, alternate nostril breathing is good for this. And they'll say, oh yeah, I do alternate nostril breathing. And I'll say, but do you? And they'll say, oh yeah. And I'm like, but do you? And they're like, no, I don't. So, you know, you have to do it, and you have to do it every day. The days you don't do it,
right,
you'll have hot flashes and night sweats. And the days you do do it, it helps a lot.
Okay, amazing. So those are simple things that you can do. Let me jump to, I want to go back to some of the menopausal symptoms specifically. I mean, you've already mentioned that for hot flashes and night sweats, the Nadi Shodhana is a very good practice. The Abhyanga is very good for any sleep issues because, you know, the disruption of sleep, that's usually insomnia is caused by a nervous system that's heightened, according to Ayurveda. What would you say as far as, you know, the vaginal dryness, sort of the dryness that people feel? I know that that is a big issue, and it's one that many women don't talk about.
Right. So the Abhyanga is also very good for dryness, exactly, for the dry skin and so forth, and having good quality oils, that's useful in the diet. But in terms of vaginal dryness, I'm not in practice anymore, but what I used to suggest to patients, and they had very good results, was Shatavari ghee. And it's a bit messy, but it's very useful. So, you know, using a little liner in the underwear or something, and or using it at night and, you know, having a little towel or something, that can be really useful for that.
Okay.
And one thing about the Nadi Shodhana, the reason that that's useful is again based on this idea of duality of Brahmana and Lungana, because the internal channel associated with the left nostril is called Ida, and that is associated in the body with the Brahmana, with Lungana, with Brahmana, with the calming, nourishing, grounding aspect of things, the lunar aspect. And Pingala is the channel, inner channel associated with the right nostril, and that's more associated with Lungana, with the light, hot, stimulating, motivating, dry thing. Right. And so when you activate both of those channels together in a very gentle way, they harmonize and they balance each other so that we don't have an excess of one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's amazing. And so, and even for like joint muscle aches, because again, that can be something that starts to happen with the lightening of the bone. From my understanding, Abhyanga is a great practice for that.
Yes.
But also,
and with that, maybe, you know, if you've got joint and muscle pain, Mahanarayan oil is useful to apply right on the joints. And, you know, this is why a little morning daily routine is so useful, is we can consider, you know, what are my weak areas? What are the challenge areas? And again, we go to Sunday, the joints. And the joints are, you know, that we start getting that joint pain. And so using Banyan Botanicals, and I don't get paid to say this, they have a preparation called Joint Balm. And that's fantastic. That's fantastic. It has castor oil in it and boswellia, which is frankincense. And if you rub that a little bit into the joints and kind of, you know, move the fingers around like this, you know, these fingers, like all the little capillaries, stuff gets stuck in there. So, you know, spending a little time in the morning, in the daily routine part of our life on the bits that are going to be the challenge areas is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And then the last menopause symptom that I get asked a lot about, and this might be a longer discussion, but is, you know, the weight gain, weight redistribution. And I know just right. The dietary changes that we can make can help with that. Is there anything else specifically?
Yes, there is something specifically. And again, I have to point people to the class specifically on this. The online class talks about this a lot because it doesn't make sense, right? Well, if we're getting drier, vata,
right,
drier and lighter, and that's lungana, then why are we gaining weight? And the short answer is when stress goes on long enough, it affects the endocrine organs, all else being equal, in the following order. First, the adrenals. Second, the insulin-producing portion of the pancreas. And third, the thyroid. Think about how many people have thyroid things going on. And then ovaries and other things. But when we look at that and we look at that insulin-producing portion of the pancreas, that's where we end up getting that weight gain, that middle weight gain. So you'd think that going out and jogging and jumping and being on a trampoline would take care of that. But sometimes slowing down and doing less takes care of that more because we're addressing it's vata pushing kapha at that point. It's not, right. It's not that you need to be moving more. It's need to be moving less, quieter kinds of movement. So that's one thing. But the other thing that I would say is I think that there's a natural, healthy tendency of the body to bring a little bit more weight for a while around menopause, because the first 5 years after menopause, there's a tremendous bone dump. We start dumping bone faster than we've ever done it before. And if we have a little more weight on us during that period of time, that's not a bad thing, because adipose is one of the sources of estrogen after menopause. And estrogen doesn't build bones, but it does have a protective effect on, you know, on too much osteoclastic activity, too much bone breakdown activity.
Yeah, amazing. And then the last question I really would have is, as far as remedies go, what are some of the herbal remedies? And I know that you can't, you know, prescribe anything, but if people are looking to see, you know, what could they possibly use, and then they could ask an Ayurvedic practitioner and work with them, what would be some of those to think about?
Well, I put some of these things in the book. So, you know, there's a long list. So I'll leave that to the book for the most part. But I would say that it's really important not to read something on the web and think, oh, shatavari is good for women, I'll do that.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely got to be tailored to what's going on with you. So, you know, shatavari is one of the most famous women herbs.
Yes.
But I find it's a little estrogenic. And if you have some kind of mass, something going on, masses, fibrocystic changes in the breast, any kind of masses, heavy bleeding, estrogen dominant kind of profile, you want to avoid shatavari.
Yeah.
And if you don't, and you're underweight and really nervous and anxious, it could be perfect for you. But really see somebody for the herb. That's the best thing for the herbal stuff. We'll have enough to do as non-practitioners with the medicine of subtraction, seeing what in our lives we can take away, changing our diets, doing that kind of thing. Leave it to somebody who really has experience in this to help, because they'll give you something. It'll work pretty well, but in 3 months, you can tweak, you can meet with them again and they can tweak it. They can see what's going on. Follow up with them. Don't just get it and go, oh, it doesn't work.
Right.
Take it and then follow up with them 3 months later, 6 months later, you know, every 3 months for a while, every seasonal change for a little while. What are the tweaks you can make?
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that. And I was hoping you would say that because I think there is this, you know, ability to Google anything. You just look it up and it's, oh, it's Shatavari. And everybody is like, okay, I'm going to take that. But I think what I'm so glad you said is that you must, you really need to work with an Ayurvedic practitioner before you start those herbal remedies. And like you said, there's so many things you can do that are before the herbal remedies. So start with those.
Right.
And then if you're having a lot of difficulty, go to someone who can really guide you and help you with the herbal remedies. So I think that that's wonderful. And then, you know, one last question is, how do you see the role of community in menopause and the changes? You know, in so many cultures, community and connection is such an important role of, you know, any human contact or any, for any humans, but especially for women. How have you seen that that is helpful?
Well, it's such a great question. And it's been on my mind for a while. And starting next month, I'm starting a membership-based offering called Menopause Chronicles, where we learn by talking to each other and we develop and support community. And we have women who I've been talking to about women's health, because I've been in this business for a long time of women's health. There's this wonderful women around the world who have created a community just by talking about this stuff. And now we're part of this community, right?
Right.
And so they'll come on and we'll talk about it. And more in my life, as I move into Vanaprastha, I know that I don't know everything. And the way that I continue to learn is hearing from everybody's stories. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I think we learn from each other. And one of the things that happens when we're together long enough, and it's not teacher teaching the classroom, it's us learning together.
Sure.
That's what a community is. It's not, I'm going to go and get the information I need and go back home. It's, let's have a community. And what happens with that is connection. And one way to look at this from a Western point of view is, what happens with connection is an increase in oxytocin. And what happens with an increase in oxytocin, it counteracts some of many of the negative effects of excess cortisol and adrenaline, which is excess stress, and starts a repair process. Thought creates biology. So when we feel that stabilizing effect of connection, that has a stabilizing chemical process that it triggers in the body. So one thing I would want to say about, you know, going out and getting a practitioner, you had said, you know, if you're having trouble, go get a practitioner. And I would suggest too, even if you're not having trouble, get a relationship with a practitioner so that when you do get in trouble, because we will someday, you're not trying to dig the well when you get thirsty, you know? So I think that's useful.
Yes, absolutely. And so this feels like such a good place for us to wrap up our conversation. Although I could keep talking to you and keep asking you questions, and hopefully I will have you, I would love for you to come back again so we can do a deeper dive on some of these topics that we sort of just touched on very, very briefly. I would love that.
I'd love that. And you can come on to Menopause Chronicles too.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Great.
And, you know, so the last question I always ask every guest, you know, when they come onto the podcast is, you know, if I offer up the phrase to catalyze healing, because this podcast is called The Healing Catalyst, but if I offer up the phrase to catalyze healing, what comes up for you?
If I had to finish that sentence, I would say, to catalyze healing, listen to my innermost essence.
Mm, that's beautiful. Dr. Welch, thank you so much. It has been an honor to talk with you. I am so grateful to you for sharing your wisdom with my listening community and with me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Dr. Avantiji, it's a great pleasure to be here, and similarly, a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thanks again for listening to The Healing Catalyst. If you love what you heard, please hit follow and pass it along to a friend. And if you're feeling really inspired, please rate and review so that others can find this podcast more easily. To learn more, head to AvantiKumarSingh.com. And to connect with me directly, find me on Instagram at AvantiKumarSingh. I'll be back next week and hope that you will be too. Until then, remember, with the right catalyst, you have the power to activate your own healing, because healing starts within.